Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Lewis Roth with Americans for Peace Now, who assesses the strength of Israel's peace movement after 17 months of escalating conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. Marion Wright Edelman, founder and president of the Children's Defense Fund, who discusses a legislative proposal to restore essential services to welfare law, gutted in the 1996 Reform Bill. And Kirk Davies with Greenpeace USA, who explains why environmental groups have condemned the Bush administration's recent proposal addressing the problem of global warming. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
With little fanfare, the Democratic National Committee has shortened the 2004 presidential primary season. The DNC at its winter meeting passed a plan proposed by party chairman Terry McAuliffe to let states start picking convention delegates 1 week after the New Hampshire primary, eliminating a gap of 5 weeks that existed in the 2000 primary race between Al Gore and Bill Bradley. According to The Nation magazine, the new primary schedule will give more power to party fundraisers and consultants and take away the influence that grassroots party activists have in key states. Mike Dolan, a long-time voter registration organizer, blasted the new primary schedule as a shift of power inside the Democratic Party from precinct-based politics to a cadre of consultants, hacks, and Washington insiders. The new primary schedule, designed to match the Republican primary calendar, will also likely limit the types of candidates who can run a serious primary campaign. It will likely aid good fundraisers such as Al Gore, Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman, and North Carolina Senator John Edwards, while possibly crippling issue-based campaigns by progressive politicians like Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold or Minnesota Senator Paul Wellstone. Clearly, McAuliffe and the DNC insiders are looking to boost their own power and further marginalize the work of local party activists, thereby containing the progressive impulses in the Democratic Party. The federal case against Nikki Scarfo started out as a typical organized crime bust. Scarfo was involved in a sports gambling and loan sharking operation, raking in $5 million in bets a year, a decent take for the Gambino crime family. The case soon got very complicated. The FBI discovered that Scarfo, 36, son of the violent boss of the Philadelphia South Jersey mob, kept all his gambling records on a laptop computer, and he had encrypted his most important files, preventing the feds from gaining access to them. According to Mother Jones magazine, the case against little Nicky soon exploded into a major civil liberties affair, after the government disclosed in court papers that the FBI had used a classified national security device, called a keystroke recorder, to open up Scarfo's computer files. In June 2000, the federal government indicted Scarfo on gambling and loan sharking charges. Still, Scarfo's defense lawyers tried to get the evidence tossed out. They wanted a full public explanation about how the classified device worked. U.S. prosecutors refused to disclose the information, citing national security and the need to follow the Classified Information Protection Act that shields government secrets. After the September 11th terrorist attacks, prosecutors secretly provided the judge in the case with a full description of the device, and he later ruled that the government could keep classified information of the device secret. Along with new powers given to the FBI for wiretaps, the Scarfo case has opened a lot of eyes about how far the FBI and other agencies will go to use secret technology in criminal investigations. As Alan Hart, a criminal justice professor, commented, "This doesn't just smack of Big Brotherism, it hits you over the head like a baseball bat." The Progressive magazine reports that greed is still the king at Las Vegas casinos. While the flow of tourists to Las Vegas has slowed since September the 11th, casino owners have found a way to keep the profit machine running, at the same time laying off 15,000 union hotel workers. During the recent boom in Las Vegas, the hotel union affiliate Culinary Workers Local 226 won new contracts and big wage boosts for its members. Now the resort owners are fighting back. A new resort, called The Palms, opened in November 2001 without a union contract. It has packed in the crowds while offering sub-union wages to bartenders, dishwashers, and banquet servers. Local 226 organized a huge picket with 1,500 hotel workers outside The Palm. Union member Paul Rutledge, who works at the MGM Grand Casino, blasted the corporate-owned resorts. He insisted, "A lot of people who should be at work are not, because the owners want to make more money. We work like dogs. It's not fair." Although business fell off 11% at the casinos last October, they did better than expected by taking in $358 million in total revenue. They did it partly by cutting down on the take won by gamblers. Life remains tough for Las Vegas service workers without unions. Once in Las Vegas, many immigrants go to find help at the Dolores Huerta Center for Worker Rights. The center helps day laborers and others win back pay awards and other benefits from exploitative employers, a situation not uncommon in Las Vegas. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.
Seventeen months of escalating bloodshed between Israelis and Palestinians continues to claim lives. Recent events have included Palestinian movement rocket launches, Israeli fighter jet assaults, Palestinian suicide bombings, and assassinations carried out by the Israeli army. The Palestinian death toll has now reached more than 1,000, 248 of whom are children, while 262 Israelis have lost their lives in this latest intifada or rebellion. But for all the focus on blood and war, Israel's peace movement is still alive. Over 20,000 Israelis rallied in Tel Aviv recently, calling for their nation's withdrawal from the occupied territories and a resumption of peace talks. Some 230 Israeli Army reservists also affirmed their rejection of the status quo by signing a petition declaring they would not continue to fight beyond Israel's 1967 borders in order to dominate, expel, starve, and humiliate an entire people. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Lewis Roth, Assistant Executive Director with Americans for Peace Now, who assesses the strength of Israel's peace movement after 17 months of escalating conflict.
Peace Now in Israel was started in 1978 when a group of about 350 reserve and combat officers took out an open letter in the newspapers to then Prime Minister Menachem Begin asking him to sign a peace treaty with Egypt. And that was a very unusual political step at that time for reserve officers to be taking. It got the attention of a lot of people in Israel, and it gradually snowballed into becoming the Peace Now movement, which is now the largest grassroots organization working for peace in Israel. It's become known over the years for doing a lot of large-scale demonstrations. In fact, it helped organize one this last Saturday night. They had 20,000 Israelis turn out in Tel Aviv to call for an end to violence, return to negotiations, and some Israeli steps to help advance the negotiations along. But over the years, they've been able to draw hundreds of thousands of people out to the street. It was regrettably after a Peace Now demonstration that Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated. Beyond that, they also do a number of ongoing programs. They do the only continuous monitoring of the settlement movement in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, looking at new settlements, empty houses that are out there, budget allocations, that sort of thing. They run a youth dialogue program to bring together Israeli and Palestinian youth. And they also do a program to improve the living conditions in Jerusalem for all the residents, regardless of religion and national background. Americans for Peace Now was started a couple years after Peace Now got going in Israel, primarily to advance the cause for peace in the American Jewish community and to raise money here to go for the Peace Now movement in Israel. And that continues to be a major function of what we do. About 30% of all the money that we raise over here gets sent to Peace Now in Israel. But beyond that, we also do a lot of work with the media and congressional relations, work with the administration, with the Arab American community, in order to broaden the audience for the message that we have, which is that there really is no military solution for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. There's only a political one, and we need to get back to the negotiating table.
I've just read 1,000 Palestinians, 248 of whom are children, have died thus far in the last 17 months of violence since the latest intifada or rebellion broke out. 256 Israelis have also been killed. This climate is extremely difficult, and maybe you could place in context that demonstration in Tel Aviv this past week, where 20,000 demonstrated for a peaceful solution. That's quite a shift in momentum, is it not?
It's a shift in momentum going back in the right direction from our perspective. There was a rally that was held in August that drew about 10,000 people, so we've doubled the numbers over the past half year or so. Still, that's a long way away from where Peace Now and the peace camp were during the height of the negotiations, when, again, hundreds of thousands of people would come out into the streets. I think basically what's occurred in both communities, both the Israeli and the Palestinian community, with the ongoing cycle of violence, as you outlined, is a complete destruction of trust and faith in the partner on the other side. And with this lack of trust, this destruction of trust, it becomes very difficult for the other side to perceive that there's even a partner to talk to, much less negotiate with in a serious manner. In Israel, we've seen a rise of very extreme right-wing figures calling for policies, for example, the transfer of all the Palestinians out of the West Bank and Gaza. In an opinion poll on Friday, they got the support of 35% of the population. On the Palestinian side, we also see a rise in support for extremist groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad in very high percentages. Basically, what's occurring is that people are worried about their personal security in the short term, and they're willing to support very harsh measures directed against the other side. But the interesting thing is, in almost the exact same polls, when you ask both sides whether or not they're willing to go back to negotiations, consider long-term reconciliation with the other side, with the establishment of peace, they're willing to do that. In fact, there's a new poll of Palestinian public opinion that shows 70% of them want to get back to the peace talks. They're willing to engage in reconciliation with the Israelis. And this comes after a year and a half of very harsh measures, unbelievable violence directed against both sides. So in the short term, it's a very difficult operating situation politically for groups like Peace Now, but we're trying to keep focused on the long-term prize, that is, the willingness of both sides to return to the negotiating table and reconcile. And that really is what we're trying to tap into right now with some of the campaigns that are going on.
That was Lewis Roth, Assistant Executive Director with Americans for Peace Now. Contact Peace Now by calling area code 202-728-1893 or visit their website at www.peacenow.org. 30 years ago, Marion Wright Edelman founded the Children's Defense Fund to promote the well-being of America's children, especially poor children. The well-known slogan of her organization, Leave No Child Behind, was recently adopted by George W. Bush during his campaign for president. The controversial 1996 welfare reform law, known as Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, or TANF, replaced the federal welfare program that primarily benefited children. As TANF comes up for reauthorization this year, the Children's Defense Fund has proposed sweeping legislation to repair critical flaws they saw in the reform bill signed into law by President Clinton. Provisions in their Act to Leave No Child Behind include improvements in health care, housing, and education benefits for children, as well as measures to support families leaving welfare, such as transportation and child care. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Marion Wright Edelman about her group's proposals to lift children out of poverty, the price tag of the program, and her reaction to George Bush's co-opting of the Defense Fund slogan.
It was introduced last May by Representative George Miller and Chris Dodd. It now has 10 senators, and 80 House of Representatives members, and it is a coherent national vision building on the idea that children don't come in pieces. They live in families, and families live in communities, building on the best ideas that we have worked on for many years, but how do you put it all together to renovate our national house and to make each room safe? It has 12 titles, which must pass separately, and most of those titles have been introduced with bipartisan support. The overall cost for this bill over 10 years, which scares everybody to death, is $75 billion a year, but you know that's less than the tax cut that break that was given for the top 1%, and for those who get new estate tax breaks in the top 2%. So I am not at all defensive about what we would want to invest in lifting every child out of poverty, seeing that every child is ready for school, every child has health care, no child is hungry, parents have living wages and good jobs, and so it's a bargain. And so we are really very pleased and want to be clear that this nation has the responsibility and that we know what to do. The real challenge now is how do we create the political will to make it happen. It's not about money, and that's what we want to say in this country, even now in recession. It's about choices. It's whether, you know, everything in our comprehensive bill could be paid for by freezing the tax cuts, the new tax handouts for the wealthiest 1 and 2% in our nation. And so we will be moving forward this year to see that the child care block grant, which comes up for reauthorization, that we double the number of children from 2 to 4 million who are able to be served, and the welfare bill comes up for reauthorization. If we're going to require poor mothers to work, then we better make sure that their children get the high-quality child care. So all of that is one set of provisions in the Act to Leave No Child Behind, but the big focus is on how do we make sure that working people have the support they need, and particularly child care, transportation, health care, as the welfare bill is reauthorized.
After September 11th, did the number of supporters decline, or did a lot of the legislators who signed on to the bill, did that happen after the 11th, or was there a big drop-off, and do you see that as a problem if so?
Most of the people who have sponsored the bill, they did that before September 11th, but nobody has dropped off. There are a lot of people, as you know, who say, my goodness, now in light of this and the war on terrorism, that we can't afford to invest in our children. That's just absolutely wrongheaded. The issue is not between having children be insecure in their homes and in their communities and be abused or neglected or to be in homeless shelters. It's between the very wealthiest top 1% is what the real choice is, and our children's economic and health security. National security, which we support, is far more than military security. Any homeland security has to deal with the children who are being killed by guns at home, who are being neglected and abused, who are standing in line for homeless shelters, who are hungry. And so that's what real national security is, and we've got to take care of our children. We cannot talk about spending $48 billion new dollars on military security when we're letting children die from the enemies within. And so it's about balance. It's about choices. And the Bush budget makes the wrong choices. And the Act to Leave No Child Behind makes the right choices. And we can afford to keep our children safe at home within the budget and protect us from a war on terrorists outside if we just froze that tax cut, which came before September 11th. And now we've got economic downturn. Now we've got deficits. So they need to make new choices. The country needs to make new choices and say children first. Rich corporations and billionaires ought to stand in line until we don't have any more hungry and homeless and uneducated children. We are working with Senator Corzine and others who are going to be putting in our version of the welfare reform bill. And so, you know, this is a very complicated set of committees with multiple jurisdiction, and we are working with those different committees to try to get as much support as we can for child care and for work and for the supports that families need. But at the same time, we want to have people see how this fits in a broader vision because, you know, if we give them, you know, new child care, but there's no housing and they're homeless, we haven't solved the problems of those families.
One last question. How do you feel about President Bush basically preempting your slogan?
Well, you know, on one hand, you can say Mr. Bush took our slogan, and that's a good thing, but when he takes it and uses it as a fig leaf to hide unjust budget and tax policies that leave millions of children behind, then we don't like it, and we think that we need to hold him accountable for doing what he says and for keeping his promises to children. The budget documents are the way in which we really show what we stand for in this country, and this budget document shows that we stand for, at least as is reflected in the president's budget, rich corporations and rich individuals and not children, and we've got to change those choices.
That was Marion Wright Edelman, founder and president of the Children's Defense Fund. For more information on the Act to Leave No Child Behind, contact the fund by calling area code 202-628-8787 or visit their website at www.childrensdefense.org. In 2001, the Bush administration rejected the Kyoto International Climate Change Treaty, promising that they would put forward their own proposals to diminish global warming. Last week, the White House announced its plan, which depends entirely on voluntary compliance and tax breaks to gain the cooperation of the largest polluters. The policy also proposes linking the nation's economic growth to efforts to reduce greenhouse gases. As governor of Texas, George Bush backed a similar voluntary plan to reduce his state's pollution, a scheme that some environmental groups claim oil giant Exxon had a direct role in drafting. The policy was a failure and was later scrapped by the Texas legislature after Bush became president. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Kurt Davies, climate campaign coordinator with Greenpeace USA, who explains why his group and other environmental organizations around the world have condemned the Bush administration's global warming proposal and why they believe the policy will actually increase greenhouse gas emissions by 36% above the Kyoto Treaty targets.
Well, first of all, this plan, so-called plan, is a complete fake-out. It's basically taking us back a decade or more to efforts to rely on voluntary industry efforts, which is ludicrous. I mean, we know that environmental progress is not made through voluntary efforts. If we left it in the hands of corporations, we would not be as far along as we've gotten. As far as we're concerned, this plan could have been written by Exxon. Very briefly, it says that we should not set a cap on our emissions or try to slow our emissions down and level them off, but instead tie them to the economy so that if the economy grows, our emissions essentially keep growing, our pollution keeps growing. If we have a recession, then our emissions will drop, but that's certainly no way to plan for the long term. Bush says we have to keep our economy strong so that we can be making cuts, and yet, with the strongest economy in the world, we're not willing to make those cuts. And then they blame developing countries for not making an equal contribution to the Kyoto Protocol process or so on and so forth. It's really it's not fair to the world that the largest polluter is not willing to help out. And quite honestly, it's embarrassing.
You guys over at Greenpeace have done some calculations and found that the Bush administration's proposal wouldn't decrease global warming gas emissions, but actually would increase them over time. Maybe you could explain what you guys found.
Well, the projections as of now on the growth in the economy, over the next 20 years or so, show that if you let this proposal stand, if it was turned into national policy, which of course it's not automatic, it has to go through Congress and so forth, it would allow greenhouse gas emissions to grow by about 36% over the Kyoto Protocol targets. The protocol targets, of course, said we should drop our emissions below 1990 levels starting in 2010, 2012. So it effectively says that emissions will grow by 36% over the next 10 years, which is just outlandish when other countries are trying to cut their emissions below back to 1990 levels and beyond.
Now, when we talk about the influence of the big energy companies, and of course the public focus has been on Enron for quite some time, But we know that the big energy companies have had a lot of influence in the Bush White House. And what do we know about ExxonMobil corporations and other big companies' influence here?
Well, we only know that Enron was in the room because the Bush White House had to put out, when the Enron scandal hit, that they had met with them six times or so over the past year. We know that relationship goes back many years to Texas. It's not yet known who else was in the room writing the energy policy last spring because Cheney won't reveal it, but we're sure when the truth is told that, you know, big coal, big oil, and big utilities will have been in there, and obviously they got what they want out of that policy.
Kurt Davies, maybe you could speak to the reaction worldwide about the Bush administration's proposal on global warming.
Well, the worst thing that could happen from this is that governments of the world that are planning and promising to move forward with the Kyoto Protocol and get it ratified this year internationally, a move that requires countries responsible for 55% of global emissions to be party to the deal, and with the U.S. being 25%, it doesn't leave much room for error. Thankfully, those countries all have said, this is not enough, Mr. Bush. We appreciate your humble appreciation of the issue and, you know, lip service to the urgency, but this isn't going to do it, and they are still planning to move forward. Japan has said so. It came up in talks with Koizumi there. They're still going forward with it, European nations as well. And even Brazil is now, you know, promising ratification. The world is really unifying around the Kyoto Protocol.
So the United States is really a rogue nation when it comes to global warming and the threat to the planet.
We're completely out of it. It's amazing. I mean, there's never been a more difficult problem to solve internationally. It's been called the most difficult adjustment of human behavior since disarmament. But so many more nations, everybody's involved. It's all of us, right? And every country, either stands to be hurt or stands to, you know, need an adjustment to fix it. So, you know, it's really, again, quite embarrassing that the United States, the largest polluter, the 25% of global emissions with only a few percent of the population, are not involved at this point. And we can only hope that that local initiatives, you know, New York State has done really great things. There's great stuff going on in Connecticut. Mayor of San Francisco, the mayor of Salt Lake City, the mayor of Seattle, 100 and some cities have made promises to cut emissions. New England states have joined with the eastern premiers in Canada on an emissions cutting track. We can only hope that those efforts actually start to bring our emissions down so that when we get a more favorable administration, we can walk back into the global treaty and not be damaged.
That was Kurt Davies, climate campaign coordinator with Greenpeace USA. Contact Greenpeace by calling area code 800-326-0959 or visit their website at www.greenpeaceusa.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Top. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Monat, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Curry.